Welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. I'm Leslie.
And I'm Tessie.
And we are sisters-in-law. On this podcast, we interview women, moms, people who are making waves in their corners of the world. Maybe not big enough waves to make the front page or national headlines, but waves nonetheless. And we believe that they are really the true heroines of our time. Because within their circles of influence, they are encouraging other women around them to live lives full of love and compassion. We want you to hear from them because a lot of times you are these women. These people are just like you. And you just might not know that you really do share so much in common with them. And we also think it's about time that the world woke up to the realization that girls really are the ones who are running this place.
Absolutely. So on Mondays, we have interviews with our guests, but on Wednesdays, Leslie and I tackle topics that either our mama bears ask us to discuss or that have kind of been weighing on us, really. So Leslie, this morning, probably a little too early since I'm on Eastern time and you're Central Standard.
I did wake up to your text message, but that was really not unlike any other morning. I know that you are up and at work usually around the time that I'm opening my eyes and hitting snooze on my alarm.
That's right. You're right. Most mornings you probably do wake up with a text from me. Specifically this morning, I wrote to you thinking we should record this podcast. So normally, Mama Bears, we record a podcast pretty far in advance to leave time for any editing and researching that needs to be done, to compile the show notes, all of that to give you really a better listening experience. But the subjects we're discussing today have just been on my mind too much. And I was driving all day yesterday, really, to and from baseball and softball, and this morning, and I just kept wanting to call you, Leslie, and talk to you about them. Sometimes there are things in the national news that I think I know how I feel, but then I'll talk to a good friend and really be able to hook into how I actually feel. You know, you bounce ideas off each other or, you know, change your opinion if their opinion's different and yours was wrong initially, something like that, you know, and I just kept wanting to talk to you. And I thought, I bet our listeners want to hear from their friends as well. And we're their friends, basically. So today we're talking about some timely issues. We are nervous. I mean, I think I can speak for both of us that we're a little nervous about talking about first the young toddler who fell into the gorilla enclosure in Cincinnati, Ohio. We're going to talk about Brock Turner, the young man convicted of rape and sentenced to 6 months in prison this week. And we're going to talk about the role of parents in each of these cases. Is this their fault? Is this not their fault? And is there something we can do to ensure that we are never faced with either of these things as parents?
I can't wait to talk to you and sort this all out myself. I 100% agree with you. I welcomed the text message that you sent this morning, and I too am nervous. I feel like both of us are talking really fast because we're nervous. And so I think our mama bears will hopefully be able to pick up, probably will be able to pick up on the fact that we are coming at this from really just a genuine curiosity and concern. I am so fired up about this conversation. We're kind of going rogue today, and I'm pretty excited about it.
We are. You know, like I said in the intro, we genuinely usually, we don't script everything out, but we have main points, and we're just really, we try almost like just genuine reporting of an issue. Obviously, we bring some of our own personal beliefs into the podcast, but we allow for the fact that there are millions of people and millions of ways to move about the world, that not everything is right. And this one, we get a little personal, you know, and I can feel and hear us climbing on our soapboxes a little bit, which we genuinely try not to do. We try not to do that because we're not saying what we believe is always right or the only way to believe, right? But we're climbing, and I don't think we can come down.
I don't think so either. I think Mama Bear has been poked, and yes, she needs to talk this out.
Okay.
So let's do it.
Let's do it. So So Leslie, why don't you maybe just give a little bit of background for our listeners?
Okay, so in May, I'm sure you all heard about this. In May of this year at the Cincinnati Zoo, a three-year-old climbed through a barrier, right, and fell into a gorilla enclosure. So this gorilla dragged the boy around, I think it was almost 10 minutes of time, and then the zoo staff eventually shot and killed the gorilla. So this became a huge controversy, and a lot of people blamed the mom of the young boy for not keeping a closer eye on him. So that's sort of the nutshell version of the story we're working with.
So that's the first story we're going to talk about. The second story is Brock Turner. He's a 20-year-old Stanford University student who was found guilty in March and just this week was sentenced to just 6 months in prison for rape. Two male witnesses saw him raping an unconscious woman behind a dumpster and chased Turner down and held him there until police arrived. As to why he was sentencing Turner to far less than the 14-year maximum, this judge of the case said essentially that it was a lapse in judgment and that the judge didn't believe Turner was a threat to anyone. This judge was a Stanford graduate as well, and there's now a petition to recall him. We will link to that petition in the show notes if you're interested in lending your voice to his removal, but that is newsworthy as well into what we're kind of going to get into. So those are the two main things we're going to talk about today. So Leslie, let's get into the gorilla incident first.
This really, I don't know if you're on social media at all. Well, I know you are, Tessie, but it just kind of filled the Facebook feed for a number of days, and so much of the commentary was about the mom and what I guess the public thinks that an actual role of a mom should be. What it made me think of, Tessie, we all, many of us are listeners with our own toddlers or with nieces and nephews or experience with little children, and it made me think about how easy it could have been to be this particular mom. And yeah, I was talking about it with our mother-in-law, and we immediately, that's kind of like legend in our family of when your husband, Zach, was young, I don't know, how old was he? When he almost fell to his death, literally, like for real, at the Grand Canyon.
Yeah. The story goes that Zach was, I'm not going to guess on his age because I can't remember, but it was around that toddler 3-4 age, if I remember correctly. At that time, there were just kind of any, standard railing that you would see at a football game or something like that. And his parents were taking a picture or dealing with their other children. And Zach, my husband, kind of crawled through the railings and, as his dad tells it, was literally holding on with one hand and looking over the edge of the Grand Canyon. And Frank didn't want to scare him, so he just casually and slowly grabbed the back of his neck and shirt and gently, not so gently, pulled him onto the right side of the barrier. But I did. That was the first thing I thought of when I was hearing all of this uproar for the mom. And I couldn't help but think anyone who was blaming the mom has never had a toddler.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, or they've just kind of forgotten how toddlers behave, right? Yeah. I mean, that story of Zach just brings me, like, my knees start shaking when I hear that story still. And I've heard it so many times now. But I think part of that is because, like, at this really visceral level, like, I get it. Like, the danger is real. That could happen to any mom anywhere throughout space, throughout time.
Yes.
I mean, fairly clear the way we're talking about this situation that we don't really blame the mom for this. Like, I understand that these things happen.
Clearly, this was the worst case scenario for the mom. And so why do you think it was so easy for so many people to do that, Leslie?
I don't know. I think part of it is that it goes back to sort of those crazy high expectations that we all put on mothers as a collective society. I mean, we think moms should have it all together all of the time. We should always know what's going on with everyone, what their needs are, and basically have eyes in the back of our heads. Yeah. So I think that this is sort of a way that that really small notion of just like, oh, she should have it all together played out in a really major way.
Yeah. And I was also thinking too that there's this just high expectation of us to not be human as moms in terms of like we're expected to have zero distractions ourselves, even though we are singular people who have mm-hmm. our own interests, have our own fascinations with things. You know, we have conversations with our friends sometimes when our kids get into shenanigans and we've been talking to a friend. And all of this is natural and it's normal and it's actually really healthy in a lot of ways. And I don't know what this mom was doing, but I'm just saying there is this crazy unrealistic expectation as well that we can't be distracted, that we have to be 100% eyes on our children at all times. And that's just totally unrealistic.
Yeah. And it makes me think about how in so many other parts of the world, child raising really comes down to a community of people who mm-hmm. care for the children. And, you know, in this case, like if I would have, well, I like to think that I would have done this, who knows? But like, if you see a kid that you're kind of worried about maybe falling into an enclosure or, you know, overstepping bounds in some way that's really going to bring harm, like serious harm. I'm not going to discipline your kid for cursing or something in front of me. But like, if I see that something's going to possibly happen, like can we step in? Or maybe we've gotten so far away from that idea of just like, we are a shared humanity that we don't act anymore. I don't know. I'd be curious, like, where, let's not just blame the mom if we're pointing fingers. Yeah. Where was everyone else?
Right. Absolutely. Because it did, in one of the articles I was reading, again, when it kind of the big push, the hubbub was there, was that people had seen him going through these barricades. And I'm like, why didn't you stop him then? And again, it's easy to say from our point of view. And I don't want to mm-hmm. shift blame to anyone either. Because the reality is, as moms, we are not in control at all times, especially toddlers. Like, toddlers can be kind of dumb, you know? I mean, they just mm-hmm. they have no idea what they're doing. They don't know what's going on. And so, you know, but they're also their own little people experimenting with independence, trying to figure out where the line actually is. This is like quintessential toddlerhood. And like that preschool age. And so the idea that we would have control over these humans, these budding humans, is also insane.
It is. I mean, what do we really have control over, Tessie? I mean, to point so much anger and blame toward one person's lack of control, the mirror reflects back. Like, what are we in control of? Nothing, really.
Exactly. And I think we have to mention it here, but we'll go into it a little deeper in a bit, but there is an element of race here. Anyone who says that a white mom would have been put to task quite as much as this other woman of color was, this mom of color, I think they're just lying to themselves. There's no way the public would have really charged a white mom with this like injustice for this gorilla dying because of the child. There's no way. And really our history shows that. So we're actually mm-hmm. going to get into that a little more later, but I do want to note that here, that we believe that there is an element of that as to why the mom was kind of punished by the media and by society as a whole.
Yep, absolutely. How much of a role do you think parents actually play in these situations? And how can these types of things be avoided? I mean, we kind of touched on the actual situation of like, maybe if someone else would have jumped up, or there's lots of ways that could have played out. But as sort of an American culture, like what role do parents really play in this sort of thing happening and then the response that follows?
Right. I mean, I think we have to do our very best to be sure. And especially in public places, I'm sure you can agree that like you are constantly being watched. You just are. That's not really, as a mom especially, I feel like you are being watched. You're under a microscope a little bit. So do your best. Mm-hmm. And then understand that, like, you, these things cannot ever be totally avoided, unfortunately, because like we said, toddlers are weird. Hope for the best as well.
Yeah, maybe it helps put things in perspective too when you're thinking about, like, I remember once we were in a two-story Target with an elevator and Oliver got in the top floor and the door closed, right? Like, this is a nightmare scenario for any parent. I was hysterical. And of course he was fine. Someone was holding his hand downstairs. But those situations, I guess my hope is that this woman, even though she suffered not only the trauma of what happened, but then this backlash that, you know, yeah, the public decided to unleash. I hope she can kind of find a little bit of, like, spots of forgiveness, just like I ultimately have forgiven myself for that very small mistake that was made. Yeah. We do this every single day. We're making mistakes. We're doing the best we can. I hope that, you know, these things, these moments of being in the valley don't define us as moms. I mean, it's so much easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. And the biggest thing too, Mama Bears, is to remember that, like, the best thing you can offer that woman is grace, even if it's just, like, through a prayer or through, you know, kind of like some energy sending her, because we've all been there on, right? Clearly not to this scope because it was so public, but I just think we, as mama bears, we need to stop judging each other so much and really just extend, like you said, the forgiveness, the grace, the all of that, so that we get it back to us when this happens to us, you know?
Absolutely. Tessie, another problem, since we're up here on the soapbox, that I have with this whole story that played out in the week is that during this time period, this short week of extreme disappointment and whatever it was we were unleashing on this woman in Cincinnati, nearly 1,000 migrants died in the Mediterranean Sea. So where about that? Why is it that we are shaming this mother and we are mourning this monkey? Where is our fire? Like, don't we have any fire left from like the nearly 1,000 people who died? I mean, this just infuriates me. It should have been, I believe, the thing that we were focusing on. And I just long for the day when we can figure out, just as a collective whole, how to be productive in our outrage and in our grief.
You guys, it's true. Let's put all of our energy and our grief into the lives that are being lost, but maybe not heard, right? So I'm with you. Mm-hmm. That was so hard.
All right, Tessie, let's talk about this other horrible thing. Right. Oh, right. So much of this Brock Turner case has to do with our society, with our culture of rape. I don't know how else to say it. Yeah. Rape culture might most simply be described as a culture, including its media, that normalizes both the sexualization of women and the sexual aggression of men. So because of this, when sexual assault does occur, the victims tend to be blamed in their aggressors. And I just don't even know what to say about this. Rape culture, it perpetrates these rape myths, such as, you know, the victim asks for it by the way that she was dressed or the way that they were drinking. And that sort of real colloquial, cute, boys will be boys and can't be held accountable for their testosterone fueled bodies. I'm over it. I can't even.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's real. It's the place that we live.
One of my friends actually from high school, her name is Jessica Berthasel. She is actually going to be on our podcast at some point. We're in talks to speak with her, but she wrote a really great piece about this. We're going to link to that in the show notes. We're going to get more into what rape culture means, but sometimes when I see men commenting on rape, or in this case, the Brock Turner case, on social media, I think that they don't get the full grasp of the problem, you know, that this is like, this is a huge problem. This is not just a once every once in a while thing that's happening. So I kind of thought we'd just give a few statistics to show the scope of it, right? So there are 89,000 reported rapes a year. So rape is often cited as one of the least reported crimes. That number is undoubtedly shockingly higher, but it's just so hard to quantify because it does have this like cloud of mystery. And because, like you said, the victims are often blamed. And so that all leads to people not reporting rape. But 89,000 a year is insane.
Yeah. Every 2 minutes, an American is sexually assaulted. And on college campuses like Stanford, where the Turner case happened, 11.2% of women experience rape or sexual assault. And again, that's the reported numbers. The unreported numbers would overtake that already shocking 11.2% and make it a lot higher.
And the truth is, Leslie, and I'm sure you can agree on this, but virtually every woman I know has been pressured into going further sexually than they wanted to at the time. So these aren't like qualified as rape. They don't qualify for that term. But Amy Schumer, who's a comedian, she calls this grape. She has a whole, well, she has a skit on it on her show, The Gray Area of Rape. You know, when she first talked about this, I of course thought about my history. And there was this one point in high school that I was going on a first date with a boy. We went out to eat and then we were going, we rented a movie and we were just going to his house. And a lot of times in high school, you know the person ahead of time. And I went to a really big high school, but I didn't know him all that well. This really was just more like a get to know you kind of date. We got back and we were just watching the movie and he brought out this cup of oil. And I was like, what is going on? Like, it just, we hadn't even kissed at this point. Okay. And we brought out this cup of oil and he basically went on to tell me how he wanted to get a hand job using this oil.
Oh my God.
Yes. And it, like to this day, it makes me almost want to throw up. And
yeah,
thank God. I was just like, that's not happening. And which is not my personality, to be quite honest with you. I did way more than I would have wanted in high school, earlier than I would have wanted, I should have said, because I am a people pleaser and I didn't know how to say no, right? And so I'm not sure what it was about this situation, probably because I didn't know him and didn't care if I disappointed him, but I was able to go. But there was definitely an assumption like, oh, we are back here and this is what's going to go down. And every one of my friends has some story like this, right? It wasn't rape. Nothing actually happened. But there was definitely pressure to do something.
Right. So I think beyond that, beyond these stories, is just the way that we are kind of cultured to fear in general. I mean, I remember walking around my college campus and having to really be careful. Like, where am I walking? Am I alone? Is it dark? Do I have my rape whistle? All of these things that are just so very much normal to us. They've been completely normalized in our, especially college campus life, that we don't even really quite understand the effect that it has on us because it's just so much a part of the world we live in.
Exactly. Any woman can tell you there are thousands of microaggressions that feel just as repulsive, right? That make you feel scared, intimidated, fearful. Just walking down the street and being catcalled is a microaggression that's on the same like side as rape, right? It's this idea that women are not human enough to warrant like some respect. So there is that culture of like boys will be boys and boys will be commenting on ladies' bodies, which no, we're done with this. We are over that idea. And I think this is one case where parents do have a role in this.
Yeah. And just speaking of parents, it's really tricky because, as you know, the dad of Brock Turner wrote a letter to the judge during this trial and the sentencing after, asking him to go easy on his son. And I'm going to quote this and it makes me sick. 20 minutes of action were not enough to take away an entire life he's been working hard to build. The letter goes on to say that his son has suffered from depression and anxiety in the wake of the trial, and having to register as a sex offender, you know, that this would really ruin his chances for a good life. The loss of his appetite was, you know, put in this letter. Like, he basically was saying that all of that was kind of punishment enough, which I just I know. I mean, he literally in this letter said, you know, my son used to eat steak, and basically insinuated that now he can't eat steak. So his life has been ruined enough. What?
Right. Yes. I mean, let's just start by saying, like, men, you just, unless you have been personally, because of course we're talking about women here, but boys and men are also sexually abused, assaulted, and raped. So this is not to disqualify that. But daddy, you just need to sit down and shut up. Like, this is just insane that he's even commenting about this. And just the privilege that he comes from is asinine, right? And so it does get a little tricky, because no one was talking about the parents, because this is kind of one of those situations. Brock Turner is 20 years old, so you kind of come out of the umbrella of your parents at that age. So the parents hadn't even been thrown under the bus with him until the dad wrote the letter. And and then it was like, fair game, son. So we thought, because he brought himself into it, we would talk about the role that parents do have, because we believe there is a role to be had. And you and I are both parents of both boys and a girl. And so we have kind of a vested interest in doing our due diligence to make sure that neither of this happens on either side of that.
Right, right. Either side. Absolutely. There's just as much of a responsibility to teach our girls as there is to teach our boys too. And I think that it really is. It's our duty as parents. You know, the goal is kind of the end game, that you get them out of the house at 18 and you want them to be productive, good citizens of the world and know how to behave. And although this is a topic that's talked about, like, it's part of life, and your sexuality is something that, you know, I for one want to have a role in helping my children navigate.
Absolutely. One of the main things that could help, like, you and I are just trying to brainstorm, like, what could help to tackle this culture of rape, to overturn it, you know, to make it not something that every 2 minutes an American is experiencing sexual assault. Like, what can we do as parents to ensure that we're raising a generation where that's no longer going to be true? And I was thinking about really the importance and the necessity of talking about sex at age-appropriate levels. I know my parents have talked about, like, their parents didn't talk about sex. They didn't know anything about that. And I think we're getting better as generations go along, because we realize that's an important aspect of this. The kids need to know what sex is. The more it's kind of clouded in this, like, shroud of what is sex and what happens and, you know, what's okay and what's not okay, the more they can, it's been proven, they try risky behaviors. So, I mean, it's essential that we're educating our kids at the earliest available time. There are great books, there are great links and websites you can go to see what is appropriate, but we got to do it. It's hard and it's embarrassing, but we got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you were talking earlier about kind of shaping the next generation, I truly believe that this is something that our generation of moms can help remedy. I mean, we underestimate our power, and I think that's wrong. I think we have to embrace the power we have in raising our own children and the children that we have an influence on. And I don't think we're being naive or silly by thinking that by talking about these things with our kids and with each other, we really can move the barometer toward a safer and more just society.
Yes.
Another thing, I think, wrestle or tickle or roughhouse, you know, kids do that. But I think it's really important to implement that hard no or that stop. Like, if someone is uncomfortable with that sort of physical play, then we need to teach as parents and then to kind of help referee in certain occasions, you know, that if one kid says stop, then you stop. Or if a child is uncomfortable and says no, then that's a hard no.
I remember this has been a big deal for me for years. And I remember one of my friends, we were newer friends at the time. And I have four boys. They are constantly wrestling. I mean, it is a constant roughhousing situation at my house and wrestling. And I could tell that one of them was starting to get to the point where they were getting angry and over it, right? But the other one just kept picking. And so finally, the younger one said, no, I'm done. And the older one kind of shot again. And I probably went a little too crazy, but I was just like, no. Yeah, his no was not real loud, but that's it. End of situation. If you're in the middle of a shoot on his feet, you stop right there. Like, it's done. And the friend was just kind of like, whoa. And I said, I will not have my boys thinking that no is a maybe. You know, and I even, I go so far, I was actually talking to Tristan, my 13-year-old, about this because we listened to NPR and they were talking about this case. And I said, I want you to know that an I don't know is a no, that a no is for sure a no, you know, and that even you have to learn to read people. If there is a hesitation, that is a no. So, you know, even for the brothers, like I am, can you tell that he's over it? Of course you can. You know when people are done with you, so stop. And I think that's important too, like recognizing the signals and the signs, because it doesn't matter, you know, like even if there's not a no, you need to be the kind of person that stops when there's some uncomfortableness.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I agree with you. And I think it's good for the person hearing the no to hear the no and then stop. But it's also good for our kids, both daughters and sons, to say no, to actually practice saying no. I think anything, any script, you know, that we're trying to memorize, we're better when we practice. And so if we can get used to them, you know, standing up for themselves, saying no, and then, you know, having other people or other children or their friends honor that no, that will hopefully too make a difference.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, when you say honor their no's, I think as parents, we have to learn to do that too. And I can be fully honest in admitting that Dayla hates roller coaster rides, and I think it's just fear-based, but I don't honor her no. When I say, like, you should go on this, and she says no, I'm like, do it! Get over your fear! But I think of course, like, toddlers just say no to hear it and to see what you say, so, like, they're, or to see what you do. So there is that, like, that, you know, obviously age issue, but as they get older, I think we need to honor their no's as well so that they know their no's mean something and that they should mean something. And so that when they're practicing their no, they feel like I hear it, I say no and I get a reaction or I get the hell out of there, so that they can start to figure out their own agency in that as well. Yeah. The other thing I was thinking of too was for our daughters, I hear it all the time. And my kids have kind of aged out of this little saying, but when daughters will say, little Johnny's picking on me, and I'll hear parents say, oh, he probably just likes you, you know, and the kid's like teasing the daughter and pulling at their skirt or at their hair, and it's like, oh, he just, if he teases you, he likes you. And I just think, what a terrible thing we're teaching our daughters, that like these, that love is at all associated with any kind of like degrading behavior, like the teasing or the pulling, that clearly is not making the daughter feel good, right? They're saying like, oh, this person's teasing me and I don't like it. And then we're saying kind of, well, you should like it because they're just saying that they love you. We need to also stop that. I mean, that's a cultural thing. That's not just Midwest or whatever. That I think really needs to end this generation too.
So another thing kind of along those same lines, is something that I hear other people say, and that I honestly have struggled with this notion in my own mind. But I don't like it when kindergartners are assigned boyfriends or girlfriends. For instance, you know, we'll be walking and down the street or something, and oh, you have a girlfriend, or parents will say like, oh, aren't they cute? They're boyfriend, girlfriend, or whatever. And I understand that sort of, I don't know, just that need or that kind of desire to want to picture what your kids are going to be like when they grow up, and like, oh, wouldn't it be sweet if she did end up with my best friend's son or whatever. But I've always really bristled at that because I think that we're then sexualizing our children long before they're ready or interested in any sort of romantic relationship. So that's one that I really struggle with. I don't like hearing that. And I try not to say it. I think we're raising individuals. They may find love. I hope they find love in this world and in this life. But these are whole beings that we're nurturing, and they're whole whether or not they're attached to someone else.
Yeah, that's good. That's good, sister. Another thing I thought of was that depending on the age, and like I mentioned earlier, you know, with my 13-year-old, we are talking about this, but the importance of consent, you know, it's hopefully that's not a new idea. It's vigilant about not allowing your kids to continue roughhousing and wrestling and tickling after someone said no or stop. But the idea of consent in a sexual relationship, you know, specifically in a sexual relationship, that needs to be explicitly talked about. That the yes is the yes. Everything else is probably a no. You have to say, like, this is not consent. This is rape. This is sexual assault, especially as they get older. I think it's important to talk about it. The more we make it an avoidable topic, I think the less likely our kids will feel okay about talking, one, of course, to us about it, but also any questions they have. And then, you know, we want to be able to tell our child. We talked about like a community raising the kid in reference to the gorilla issue, but here too, we want to raise our kids to know what rape is so that when they see it, they're part of the group that stops it. I mean, with this Brock Turner case, it was two innocent bystanders that took him and held him down until police got there. So we want to raise our boys to be the people that do that, that stand up and say, no, she said no, or no, she's passed out. That's who we want to be raising, right?
Absolutely. And we want to raise our girls too to be monitoring for that and to take care of one another and the people that are surrounding any sort of risky situation. I mean, not all college parties are risky situations, but we definitely want to be smart about the world we live in and the part that we can play really to make it better.
Yeah. You know, as mama bears, we believe that there are certainly times for your mama bear to be poked and for your mama bear to say, wait a minute, we have a role in making sure this doesn't happen again. With regards to toddlers being toddlers and moms being human, we don't think that's where your mama bear, that, you know, the judgment should be there. And really, we're not even saying that the parents are to blame here. In terms of, like, that kid was 20 years old, and there will come a moment, a time when your kids will do something that you would never have wanted them to do and you would have never wished for them to do. And a lot of that's out of your hands. You do your very best, and then they go out in the world and, you know, you hope and pray that they stick with the things that you taught them. But this dad entered into the race. And so that's kind of why we were talking more about it. And we genuinely believe this is where your mama bear can become and do better for the next generation for our kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen, sister. Soapbox recognized.
Whoop, whoop. Shots fired.
To touch on the media's representation of everything that happened in this Brock Turner case, starting with the picture that was published of him. So with Brock Turner, in most of the early media feeds, it was his school picture. So he was all cleaned up. He was looking great, you know, had a smile, was very clean, all of those things. Trayvon Martin, on the other hand, was always pictured in a hoodie without a smile. So even the boy who fell in the gorilla cage, the media researched and they found an old mugshot of the boy's father from years ago. And that ended up being one that we saw over and over again. So I think that it's important to remember that this happens all the time. It hit close to home. I remember last year when there were three college wrestlers that were charged for an alcohol-related burglary, and they were pictured in their team pictures. They were posed, they were poised again in their suit and tie. The very same weekend, four men all arrested for burglary, and they're shown in all of the media outlets as just haggard and frankly, like really sad looking. So we just have to be conscious, I think, that these are the images that we are seeing and that our kids are seeing. And we have to ask, what is this teaching them about the world?
Absolutely. And it goes back to what I said, be very conscious of what kind of media you're consuming. When a white 20-year-old who raped an unconscious woman is pictured smiling and in his Stanford University jacket, and a young teenage boy was shot, is pictured in more like a mugshot, you have to step back and say, you know what? They're trying to make me feel things about this situation that maybe I don't feel. And then also be able to say that to your kids, depending on their age. Make sure they're also aware of the media they're consuming, because they're going to grow up the same place you are, right? So we might as well be training them to do that at an early age. And this kind of really leads to the white privilege and the socioeconomic privilege of recently, there's this case that has been brought to the media's attention. His name's Brian Banks. In 2003, he was wrongly convicted of a rape. He's a black man. He was 16 years old at the time, and he was tried as an adult. So he was originally sentenced by the judge to 6 years in prison. And I just want to remind our listeners that Brock Turner was sentenced to 6 months. But this Brian Banks, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. After 5 years in prison, the accuser of his case recanted her testimony and Banks was released after 5 years in federal prison. Okay, so again, Banks is black, Turner is white. We as a society have to start to realize that maybe our justice system is not a justice system. Understand that there is white privilege and socioeconomic privilege happening within this realm as well. 6 months isn't any rapist, especially one who was witnessed. Like, this is a for sure thing. We have to really check that kind of thing and just be open to when you hear stories of white privilege, understand that, like, this is a thing. That's an actual thing that happens in our country.
Yeah, absolutely. So where do we sit with all of this? How do we function in a world where all of this exists? And Tessie, just like we were brainstorming about how we want to be now that we know better, how we want to do better, I think we should just kind of give some ideas of how you're going to sort of internalize this and still be able to walk through the world.
That's a tough one. I'm an optimist, but even for me on days like today, it's just like, oh my gosh. But we're going to read part of the statement of the victim of the Brock Turner case. And it reminded me to just be thankful for the good people, you know, to seek out the people responding and the people lending a hand and showing kindness and showing grace. Like, I think you just have to be purposeful about just gratitude, about extending that gratitude towards, you know, the good people.
Yeah, I agree. And I think too that we want to be awake and we want to be critical in this world. I think it's really important. I always love that quote of keeping one hand on the newspaper and one hand on the Bible. And I think that can go with really one hand on the newspaper and or your favorite website or wherever you feel that you get the best news, and another hand on wherever your kind of wise and sacred compass kind of comes from. But I think it is something that, you know, we have to be awake to these things. We can still feel thankful for this world that we live in and for the good people that are here. But I think we can know more and we can then respond to that in productive, beautiful, world-changing ways.
Absolutely. You know, we don't for an instant think that this will be solved this generation, but we believe very much that we can make this a generational battle cry, that we can inform and empower our kids to change, to really change the dynamic, change the culture, and change the tide. So just be encouraged, Mama Bears. We're with you. We want to know how you're feeling about these. Are they keeping you up at night? I know for me, just having a daughter, I could cry right now, but it's freaking scary. It's so scary, you know? But there's a lot of hope too. And because we believe in the hope, we thought for our Mama Bear Dare, Leslie could read a portion of what the victim of the Brock Turner case had to say. We'll link to her entire letter in the show notes. Please make sure you read that. It's extraordinary. It is
absolutely incredible. I mean, it's a timeless, beautiful piece of writing, and read it and send all your good stuff to this victim. It's incredible. Today, Mama Bears, on behalf of the victim of this rape, we leave you with a dare from her. She says, "Finally, to girls everywhere, I am with you. On nights when you feel alone, I am with you. When people doubt you or dismiss you, I am with you. I fought every day for you, so never stop fighting. I believe you." As the author Anne Lamott once wrote, "Lighthouses don't go running all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there, shining. Although I can't save every boat, I hope that by speaking today, you absorbed a small amount of light, a small knowing that you can't be silenced, a small satisfaction that justice was served, a small assurance that we are getting somewhere, and a big, big knowing that you are important. Unquestionably, you are untouchable. You are beautiful. You are to be valued, respected, undeniably every minute of the day. You are powerful, and no one can take that away from you. To girls everywhere, I am with you. Thank you."
Have a great week, Mama Bears. Thanks for listening.
Have a good week, Mama Bears.